Адыд мацуси акуршу азго аптакуи шрицшадзом шара, рахра риштуит. Адзыпхакуи ахчи жянтанцахуи, ажени цаашим маур пхоара амцакыма, инакзалык шгурхетра шитширпшцойт матапшцалы хахвятралы, шитширпшцойт матапшцалы хахвятралы, шитширпшцойт матапшцалы
хахвятралы,
Welcome to Subject Object Verb. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. Today's episode will be a dual episode featuring Denise Gul and Noor Mubarak, two multimedia artists who work with sculpture, music, language, and ideas. Denise Gul works with all of these elements in combination. She presented her five-person buffet, which you're hearing now, as a text which was to be performed as a sound score in Chicago. The text was inspired by Denise's travels across her native Turkey to Iran, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. Today she'll be presenting a reading from her most recent book, which is titled There Is Life Between Us Plus Transparency. It's an excerpt about Moshe Feldenkrais, who happens to be one of my personal favorite thinkers on the subject of the human body. She'll also present a related exercise for listeners to experiment with. But first we'll hear from Noor. A central element of Noor's work is sound, much of which she produces from her mouth, through many extended techniques. Years ago, she moved to Los Angeles with the intention of becoming a voice actor, working in films and commercials, sculpting her voice to suit every new role. This profession did not work out, at least it hasn't yet, but she did demonstrate her ability to make the sound of a baby to me, which was impressive, and which I'll play to close out this episode. Noor now splits her time between Athens and Los Angeles. She recently had a show of her mycelial works, which are made out of mushrooms, in New York at Miguel Abreu, and she put up an interactive sound work on the web art platform Courtyard. That work, like much of her work, uses the voice as its primary medium to produce noise, music, and speech. Her current project is Daphne Fono, an adaptation of the earliest known opera, called Daphne, by Jacopo Peri, which was first produced in 1598. This is the third in our unofficial series of interviews with artists who work with opera. The other two were Hunter Ravenna Hunt Hendricks and Jared Madere. I recommend them both because I make this show. Today, Noor will be discussing her process of making the opera, which translates the original libretto into some of the most morphophonologically complex languages in the world, which is another way of saying the languages that have the greatest variety of sounds, from formants to clicks to whistles to diphthongs. Noor began this episode with a wonderful retelling of the Daphne myth, on which her opera is based. It's also the story of how art was born.
It's 1598. You're Jacopo Peri and Ottavio Rinuccini. You're buds. You've been working for the Medicis, making fabulas. And the fabulas are fabulous. They have theater and musical breaks and pyrotechnics. And they're just these like grandiose parties and performances that people would go see. And then one day, Ottavio Rinuccini and Jacopo Peri are chatting and they say, what if we turned speech into music? And they said, that's a great idea. Let's try it. And so they used Ovid's Metamorphoses as the source text for their first opera. And the story of the Daphne is not inconsequential to my project, Ross. What happens in the first opera is the town is a mess. Everyone's having a really hard time because there's a python that's wreaking havoc. So the town is being burnt down even. And the chorus, so the shepherds and the nymphs, are begging for somebody to come save them. And who comes down but Apollo, who is a warrior. He's Apollo Glorioso. He comes down and he's got his bow and arrow and he kills the python. And in the opera, it starts off with the chorus saying, thank you. The sun has come and killed this python. And then Apollo is walking through the town and who does he see? But Cupid. He comes upon Cupid and Venus, Cupid's mother, is somewhere in the vicinity. And Apollo, full of hubris, and he's a total asshole, makes fun of Cupid, who's a cute little flying baby. And he says, why do you have a bow and arrow? You're just a baby. I'm a warrior and I'm, you know, fit. Look at me. I look really good. And I'm a man, I'm a god. And I just killed the python. What have you done lately? And Cupid's like, hey, back up. Like, you are being crazy. I'm a god too. I know I look like a little baby, but I'm a god. And Apollo's, you know, laughs at him and makes some jokes about his bow. And Cupid, you know, and his arrow, you know, and Eros, and make some jokes. And so then Cupid goes to his mom and he's like, man, Apollo's a dick. Like, I'm going to get him. And Venus is like, you should get him. I support you. You should do whatever you want, my son. I love you. And he goes, I love you, mom. They're the love gods, you know. And so Cupid shoots Apollo with his bow. So that Apollo falls in love with the demigoddess Daphne. Daphne is this huntress who just runs around, has absolutely no interest in sex. All she wants to do is hunt, kill animals, and she's lovely, but she keeps to herself. And Cupid, she's the daughter of the river god. But she's also and immortal. So she's not a goddess. She doesn't really care. You know, she's just doing her thing. And Apollo falls in love with her. And then Cupid shoots her with an arrow so that she will be repulsed by Apollo. Probably she didn't even need to get shot by an arrow. She was just anyway repulsed by people in general. And then Apollo, you know, his eyes fall upon this beautiful maiden and he says, what is this? Who is this? I'm in love. And he starts chasing her and he's saying, Daphne, I love you. It's your lucky day. I am a god and I am yours. And Daphne is like, I have no interest in you. And she starts running and she starts running away from him and she's trying to escape. And he follows her and she starts screaming for her father, the river god. And she's like, help me. This maniac is trying to rape me and I am not interested. And her dad already knew that she was never going to be the type to get married and have kids and whatever. And he accepted that. And actually everyone was pretty cool. They were going to just let Daphne, except for Cupid, who's like, sicking his like disgusting god brother thing, not brother, whatever. So Apollo reaches out to have Daphne And at that moment, she escapes by transforming into a tree, into a laurel tree. That's how she gets away. So as his fingers start to touch her soft body, she begins to harden and turn into a wood, a laurel, which in Greek is called a Daphne. Still, in modern Greek, you call a laurel tree a Daphne. And she just, her whole body transforms, and her hair becomes leaves, and her fingers become branches. And there's a very famous sculpture of this scene as well.
Bernini,
yeah. And then Apollo becomes totally inconsolable. He becomes super sad. He loses his love. And at that point, he picks up a lyre and he starts to make music. And Apollo becomes the god of music. You could argue, and Francesca Fantiape, the leading scholar of early opera, who I spoke to about this, makes the argument that this is the story which is the beginning of art and music, which happens through unrequited love. Anywho, so then I'm going to wrap it up. Basically, also her, you know, the branches of the laurel tree then become the symbol for victory. So that's the story. So then they borrow that story to make the first opera. They perform it at the Sala de Nietzsche in 1598, another in a Medici palace. And so I'm re-performing that opera in two versions, one for Joan in LA. It'll just be the sound. And then in September, it'll open at Rodeo in Athens and in London as a sound installation, with these sculptures made of mycelium. There are fragments of the music that exist, and Francesca Fantiape did restage it. And I did see on YouTube a version that was performed in Latvia. And, you know, people have interpreted the fragments that exist. I'm probably not going to use those. The spoken aspect was very, you know, that was the whole point, was that it was speech, and that the poetics were the music. But when I saw interpretations, modern interpretations, it does sound like opera, but it's very, very chorus heavy. Mm. With the development of opera, you would get, you know, the actual mm-hmm. characters that would speak. But this is a very like Greco-Roman style. I'm interested in really taking it to the extreme. And mine is spoken in different languages and really the musicality of quotidian speech.
Not even pitched, really.
Well, I mean, that ends up happening by using Chitino, for example, which is a language with 11 tones, and the Ta language, and Abkhaz, all of these languages where the tonality is built in, and sort of, you know, so that's my interest. There's like, you know, Robert Ashley style operas where, you know, you get to really listen to the melody of a person speaking, which I love, obviously. Not obviously, I love it. And I think most people do. And so I wanted to extend that and just bring a very, you know, casual speech and have the tonality come from these different languages. And also conceptually, I mean, it makes sense to me that Apollo will remain in Italian.
Dunque, ruvida scorza, chiuderà sempre la beltà celeste. Lumi, voi che vedeste l'alta beltà che a lagrimarvi sforza, affisatevi pure in questa fronde. Qui posa e qui s'asconde il mio ben, il mio cuore, il mio tesoro.
John Cage started understanding listening as a form of music making, you know, and I think that there's a parallel between that and Robert Ashley using just speech as a form of opera, being able to hear and sense, you know, if you become attuned to it, then you start listening to things within the idea of aesthetic form, then all things take on an aesthetic form. And so I don't know by how you choose to define an opera, but you know, like the idea of reception or spectatorship or the idea of how we choose to listen is so much a part of what form is. And I think that in choosing to listen to any speech as opera, it can be that. And so I just came back from this very, very small village in Mexico, in Oaxaca, where they speak Chitino. And not very many people, well, the younger generation is starting to speak Spanish, but most people in this village speak Chitino, which is an incredible language. I mean, this is Eastern Chitino. I was trying to get San Marcos Zacatepec Chitino, but that one's really dying off. And this one, Eastern Chitino, and it's changing year by year. But it's a beautiful language with 11 tones. And it's a difference of da, da, da are all different words. You can't listen to that language without it just sounding like song.
Yes, in shin an uitzi, lari oqui ori in, suesia in chagante. Yes, in shin an uitzi,
lari oqui ori in, lari oqui ori in, lari oqui ori in, lari. Oqui ori in, lari, oqui ori in, lari, oqui ori in, lari, oqui ori in.
There's a series of translations and retranslations which happen because I'm also very interested in the relationship between language and cognition and cognitive realities. And so I'm taking the first opera. This is the translation process. Step one, take the original opera in Italian. Italian is actually really interesting because it only became the language of Italy in the 19th century, or officially, you know, in the 19th century, once the state of Italy became, you know, a unified state. Before that, you know, Venetians were speaking their native dialect, etc. And so the Italian from the 16th century is not that different. I mean, obviously it's a little different, but it's not that different from Italian today, because it was the Italian of the court, which then became the imposed language upon the entire Italian people, which happened recently. Anyway,
are those dialects all or language is pretty much gone at this point?
No. Like, for example, my friend Marta, she is from Venice, and she was telling me her grandmother doesn't speak Italian. She's Venetian. She's from Venice, and her grandmother speaks the Venetian dialect. It's like that Chitino language, you know, and this is what this whole project is interested in, too. You know, we're having this narrowing of our human instrument and of our vocal palette that happens with these sort of hegemonic structures which come and impose these language forms, which are generally a more basic, you know, and less complicated language, because it's one that can appeal to the most amount of people. And so, but what's happening in the translation process for this project is it starts in Italian, then I translated the whole thing into English, and then from English It gets translated into these different languages, and the languages are Chetino, Abkhaz, which is a language from the Caucasus, which sounds like moving through a radio. It's like a lot of beautiful. And then Ta, which is the most complicated and the most difficult to find. And Silbo Gomero, just because it's fun. It's the whistling language from the Canary Islands that shepherds speak to each other across mountains. So I think Venus maybe will be in Silbo. She doesn't have that many lines, so there will be these like whistling. Yeah, so I was in communication with a linguist at the Smithsonian, and we just had a conversation about what are the languages that are the most morphophonologically complex. So if the goal is to make an opera with the widest sound of human vocalization, with the widest palette of human vocalizations, then, you know, I was trying to make it based on that. So they're all really complicated and all very different from each other. So then they get translated into that. Each character gets one of those languages. Although the opera starts with a prelude by Ovid, Ovid will be in Latin. And in the sculptural version of this, Ovid is a hole in the wall with a vacuum cleaner stuck to it. So as you approach Ovid's character, he's just this vacuum that your hand gets stuck to. And then you walk in and there's Apollo, who remains in Italian as this god. And then there will be Cupid, Venus, Daphne, and the chorus. And each of them get a different language. And then once they all have their lines, then the whole thing gets retranslated back at Joan. It'll be back into English, and everything will be subtitled and projected and subtitled. And the subtitles will actually not be the translation from the Italian into English. There'll be retranslations from these languages back into English, but translated literally. So that the hope is to expose some of the linguistic structures which create the cognitive realities of those languages. So the example that I use is, you know, for example, in French, you say je me casse. That literally means I'm breaking myself. But it is something you say when you're leaving. It means I'm leaving. So what you would see in the libretto that's being subtitled would be I'm breaking myself, to sort of create these abstract poetics that will also reveal something about these different worldviews that are created through these languages.
It suggests that our reality across the world is becoming more narrow.
I think so. And I mean, not to say that it's as simple as just American business English. Obviously, Mandarin, people speak more, I think more people speak Mandarin than English. But it, and it's not only just that. There was also something I was reading where like AI is able to pretend that it's human more and more and more now. And, you know, there was that test, starts with an H. I can't remember what it's called. This kind of it's like the, not like Helmholtz test or something, where they try to see at what point AI can fool humans into believing that it is a human, you know, through conversations. And a funny thing happened, which is that now AI is getting better and better and better at pretending it's English, not just because AI is getting smarter, but because human language is becoming dumber. Like it's like see you, cool, like, you know, whatever. It's like really easy to pretend we're talking more like robots. There are cool poets that obviously work with those ideas. Like there's like J.H. Prynne or like the New British Poets who worked so much with the idea of taking jargon from all kinds of different fields and making poetics that are, they seem very, very opaque or obtuse because it's using sort of these words that aren't only used in very specialized fields. Then they have a sonorous quality of poetics that ends up happening, but also as you do your research and start looking into each word, I mean, there's that's when things become revealed. And I mean, I'm actually, that's what I like about being an artist and not an academic. I don't actually think that I have like a very airtight assessment of economics and language and all of those things. And my judgments are more, I think, felt, but I definitely enjoy listening to people talk. And I grew up, I went to over 30 countries by the time I was 18. You know, my family is from a diaspora, and I would be around a lot of languages that I didn't understand all the time, and I would imitate them. And I think it's a big part of my vocal practice.
Сыблақорым цаатсақа ирпсахайт ахшишарям чразиге.
Ариагу и блайтнас дешаджуте зустазалак абзебара дамшхакна дамазарцеза сыпшцара.
It is just funny as an artist to just think about words that sound good, names that we think are pretty. Why are some people's names pretty, you know? And yeah, it's music, and there's a whole musicality that's coming to it, and to focus on the music of the language is, I think, a nice thing to do.
Now we'll be hearing from the artist Denise Gul, who is based in Istanbul. I met Denise at the Sharjah Biennial, where we were both showing work. She was showing one of her conceptual sculptures made of neon, powder sugar, and sulfuric acid, just a few feet away from my work. And we walked around and discussed music, art, and writing together, and how she tries to unify them all. At that point, Denise had written a book of experimental poetry and a novella. Today she'll be reading from her fourth book, written during the early lockdowns. It's a collection of philosophical, ecological, poetic essays. For her, it's a work of personal notes, with guidance from important thinkers in her life, including Henri Bergson, Rumi, Italo Calvino, and Richard Feynman. As I mentioned before, this excerpt is on Moshe Feldenkrais. Along with Ida Rolf, Feldenkrais is one of the leading voices in the practice of somatics, a kind of philosophical body work. The excerpt is read partly by Denise and partly by Sophie Williamson, a curator and writer based in the UK. Denise reads the parts she describes as plus words, which appear in the text as plus signs inside of parentheses. Denise says there are two dueling voices in the writing, the personal and the informative. And she says that these interjecting words are dragging the personal narrative into a more spatial, abstract language realm, and opening up the space of language as a dimension. This work was translated from Turkish into English by Rana Kalici and Matt Hansen.
Feldenkrais. Moshe Feldenkrais is born in present-day Ukraine, back then within the Russian Empire, to a Jewish family. By the end of the First World War, he flees to the British Mandate of Palestine. There he gets his high school diploma and works as a cartographer while becoming acquainted with jiu-jitsu. In the 1930s, he emigrates to France to study engineering, later completing his PhD in physics, and begins to work as an assistant to the Nobel laureate Frederick Julio Curie. In this period, he founds the first Jiu-Jitsu Club of France, one of the oldest judo clubs in Europe. And around the same time, he earns his black belt. He passes his Paris years between physics and judo, a period when Feldenkrais delves into psychology, hypnosis, and the relationship of body-mind. As the Second World War hits France, Feldenkrais seeks refuge in Britain, starting to work as an engineer for the British Naval Force on a team that develops anti-submarine armor. There he invents stuff. Meanwhile, a knee injury from his youth relapses. He refuses to undergo an operation and, by observing his movements, starts healing himself. The delicacies of the treatment, later to be known as the Feldenkrais method, bear traces of not only Feldenkrais's life story, but also of many studies, particularly judo, and people which he has been influenced by.
G.I. Jurjev, Charles Baudin, Johannes Schultz, F. Matthias Alexander, Elsa Gindler, Henrik Jacobi, William Bates, Clifford Chalker, Paul Ferdinand Schilder, Erwin Schrödinger.
Judo is not a system built on responding to effect with force. It is built on the redirection of force. Feldenkrais observed judo's practical ideas together with the developments of his time and made groundbreaking discoveries on posture and movement in accord with
physics, quantum physics, biology, symbiosis, psychology, the effects of anxiety, fear, and neurosis on the body,
psychosomatic research and neuroscience,
hypnosis experiments and studies on how intentional, unintentional movement patterns affect mental imagery, physiology, behavior, and learning,
which were popular in the first half of the century.
Feldenkrais questioned, how can movement be defined within the network of interwoven relations between body and gravity, muscles, bones, and nervous system, together with consciousness, the unconscious? How does learning through movement happen?
The organism is a complex system grasped better as a whole. The circulatory system and the nervous system weave the body within a net. The organs, bones, muscles, and all the remaining structures are interconnected. Feelings cannot be thought apart from the breath, the body from the nervous system, the mind from the brain. Movement
plus behavior plus effect
can't be thought of as separate from the voluntary, involuntary seeing. When the habitual overwhelmingly bores the person with conventional individual socio-historical learnings and traumas, is it possible to act with ease
plus with minimum effort
instead of reacting to the collision effect? What is an effect when it has not become a dominant force as redirected through simplicity
plus on the surface?
Movement. Clifford Chalker, who worked for the British royal family, conducted his studies
of image and sound and how they synchronize in cinema
together with Feldenkrais. These studies subsequently re-emerged as the bodily oscillations of the Feldenkrais method. In the simultaneous movement of the pelvis and the spine, limbs and the head, the eyes and the fingers, with the idea that all parts of the body move together. This incited Feldenkrais to look at the relationship between mind-body and the movement in a new light.
How is the image completed in the mind?
He examined the capacity of the mind to process different parts of any given object
plus body
in different durations
plus processes
and the possibility of asynchrony. The movements of such a body happen to be in lapses, just like watching a film shot in 18 frames per second.
How does the same body achieve a relatively more fluid movement? How does perceptual framing, as it is termed in neuroscience, which is the reorganizing and synchronizing of the cortical activities around the same retinal event, affect movement?
Feldenkrais began to consider movement together with imagery. He conceptualized his research in his writing through the concepts of self-image and body image.
Feldenkrais breaks the fluid motion into pieces and asks, how much should an image
plus movement
slow down to dissociate from another image? Thus, the method is about understanding the movement capacity of the body through very small, slow movements. What kind of movement is there within stillness? How can movements, stillness, and the stillness of movement, this bilateral motion, be perceived? Feldenkrais seeks the body in class movement. Mind.
Venturing into abstractions on the transmissibility of feedback loops from machine optimization to human motion, Feldenkrais notices the body's capacity of movement to expand when at rest, throughout, and during cycles of motion. The body learns to the extent that it moves. Though it has to pause in order to be able to carry out its information flow. However, the impulse to steer one movement
plus posture
is a spontaneous reaction. A thoughtful act cannot be made in face of danger. Feldenkrais does not regulate movement as other disciplines would. Instead, he sets out this point of habitual movement, the reactionary movement that happens in the moment of defense.
The fear of falling, which proves breaking. To be an advantage to primates, existed long before humans evolved. The human mind
plus nervous
bears
system.
This fear has myriad ancient layers, but also newer and current ones. Every new layer is a new formation, better, meticulous, and sophisticated, incremental, transitionary, distinguishable, and permeable. The ancient layers, on the other hand, are primitive. They work in all or nothing way, though tough, rough, abrupt, and inconsistent. Primates managed to stand upright. The movement that evolved from the fear of falling formed the built environment.
Plus vertical, plus system.
The human body moved in a reflexive and a preservative way. Besides, social systems like reward and punishment prevented the body from evolving unbiased. The movement of the sort is a process of being exposed and vulnerable to influences such as rejection or restriction. To conceive how movement
plus behavior
patterned with the fear of falling and to experience a body and environment
plus system
free from this fear, the first step is to learn to go through the fear, that is, to fall.
Plus integration.
The difference between falling
plus unintentional minus fall
and falling
plus intentional plus drop.
Exercise. This exercise requires a chair and a blanket. Fold the blanket and place it on the seat of the chair. Sit on the blanket with your legs spread. Make sure you're not reclining. With both feet resting on the ground, feel how your spine stands on your sitting bones. Let your weight sink into your right sitting bone. Do it very slowly. So slow, so that this activity is almost unnoticeable to the eye. Imagine doing it if you cannot do it. Do as much as your body allows, not more. Let the movement unfold as far as it will. Don't push. Let your weight fall onto your right sitting bone. A few reps. How is your left sitting bone moving? How is your breathing? How does your spine move? What about your pelvis, your tongue? Notice whether your left sitting bone tends to rise as your weight falls on your right side. Involve your spine in the movement. Your spine leans to the right. What about your ribs? What is the quality of motion in your ribs? How is the left side of your body moving? Pause. Rest now. A few more repetitions. Then to the left.
As a consequence of repeating this act, apparently simple and almost invisible, in phases, the movement starts to happen fluidly. As a consequence of repeating this act, apparently simple and almost invisible, in phases, the movement starts to happen fluidly. An intentional movement plus focus, reveals plus an drop. Unintentional movement.
Plus release.
So easy, so fluid. All parts of the body in sync. An involuntary impulse. Action arises not through any outside effect, but by imagining. The invisible movement gives momentum to the visible one. The gaze is reflexive within.
Although there are some standing or sitting examinations, most of the Feldenkrais exercises are held on the ground.
Plus horizontal.
It's a delicate method in which time wanes slowly and movement is not forced. Total concentration is on the act's starting point. It unfolds from there, breaks into pieces, and becomes recognizable, decomposable, following a singular, unique, specific, and genuine path, though with the limits and patterns of the body. This way, deeper stratums of the mind are accessible. The habitual verse of the nervous system can be broken and learning can occur.
Slowing down the movement, as is seen in this exercise, enables the formation of novel neuromuscular paths and patterns. Feldenkrais breaks down the movement in such a way that the person who is exercising it can render their self-image frame by frame within their mind, as a breaking down of frames
plus
per second in a moving image.
Plus time.
Movement of the body is traceable when triggered by a simple act.
Plus imagination.
The person traces themselves while moving. Frequently, by means of this very effect of deliberation, the act is performed in the mind before or along with the physical action. This imaginary space
plus
is projected
movement.
Notion of the virtual, which Bergson elaborated in Matter and Memory. This imaginary space
plus movement
is the projected notion of the virtual, which Bergson elaborated in Matter and Memory.
9. Following his description of the body as an image
plus apparition,
Henry Bergson renders the concept of the virtual in relation to light. For us, all phenomena are reflections mirroring back and forth between objects, so to speak. If light passed through us unobstructed, we would be objects.
Plus body.
That would never be seen. At times, densities are such that the refraction does not occur. That is, total reflection. The luminous point gives rise to a virtual image, like a mirage. Perception occurs likewise. The luminous point gives rise to a virtual image, like a mirage. Perception occurs likewise. It is an echo of an obstructed refraction.
The way we discriminate matter is by ignoring its unnecessary or non-useful states. Our experience
plus
of
perception
matter is made
plus
possible
object.
By its measurable effects
plus representation.
On our own bodies. The brain is at the interval between those effects that pass through us and those that reflect. The misconception is this: humans experience perception from a certain position, as in the photographic imagery of things. This photograph is carefully processed by the brain via chemical and physical processes. Of course, the photograph is everywhere. There is never just one photograph. Like the atoms that weave the universe, the images are subject to motion at all times, in all directions. They are photographs showing their individual images, yet at the same time they are part of a grander, translucent whole.
With our undefined, indeterminate zones, we become black screens of this translucent photograph of the whole. A black screen
plus parchment
that the actual movement pierces through and where the virtual lays behind.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Subject Object Verb. Denise's work was co-produced by Not Only Publications and Kunstverein Milano. As promised, here's the sound of Noor imitating a baby crying.